Okay, folks, so we should be back in session here. Alana, I'm going to rely on you to give me a thumbs up if you can hear this recording. We have thumbs up from Alana. Okay.
Alana, could you cover your last slide again, please? We had lost your connection.
Yes, absolutely. No problem. Last slide. Well, just to wrap it up, I wanted to reiterate that DOE is investing in the offshore wind demonstration projects to increase the understanding and reduce the uncertainty around offshore wind and these new technologies. The demo projects will be laboratories at sea where we can collect data and learn from these first installations. They also allow for innovative technology to be tested on a limited scale so that we can evaluate the commercial viability of the technology. And finally, the demo projects will reduce uncertainty for stakeholders. We really want to use these projects to learn as much as we can so that we can make informed decisions about how we as the Department of Energy can facilitate the offshore wind industry moving forward. And that is it for me. And now I think we're going to pass it off to Diana Hayter from the DOE NEPA team.
Diana, you should be with us.
Okay. Is the slide up? Because I'm not seeing any slides at this point, Josh.
Yep, just one second. Pardon me.
Okay.
So there's all right, folks, we're going to take a 45-second pause, and we're going to be right back with you. Okay, Diana?
I'm here. And I see the slide, so thank you. I think we're good. Okay, are you ready for me to start? Josh, are you ready for me to start?
I am ready for you to start.
Okay, great. So, all right, so I'll be covering the NEPA process. And for those not familiar with NEPA, that is the Environmental Policy Act. We have a five-step process that's up on the slide at this point. And we're currently at the first step, which is the public scoping process. So public scoping is used by federal agencies to inform the public, along with other federal, state, and local agencies, on what we're proposing to do. So for the Aqua Ventus project, we're proposing to provide funding to support the development of the project, which would include the design, construction, and the commissioning of the project. So at the public scoping stage, DOE is looking for your input, and we need that to be in the form of a written comment, and specifically in regards to the project description, the alternative, and any environmental resources or issues that you want to ensure are analyzed in the environmental assessment. Additionally, if there's any additional information that you feel that DOE should be made aware of. So to help you understand the Aqua Ventus project, we, along with the University of Maine, have developed a project description for your use. It is posted on the DOE webpage, which is listed at that website there, the www.energy.gov/node/205-3718. And I encourage you to review that to help you formulate your comments that you might have in submitting to DOE. So then following the public scoping process, we will be developing the draft environmental assessment. And once the draft EA is completed, or environmental assessment, it will be posted on our website. And again, there will be an additional public comment period where we'll be asking for comments on the content of the draft environmental assessment. So be sure to check the DOE website webpage for this project for updates. And if you're on the DOE distribution list, you will also be notified of the next involvement opportunity. And once the final environmental assessment is completed, the next step in the environmental review process is to either issue what we call a FONSI, a finding of no significant impact, and that is based on the analysis in the environmental assessment, or a determination that an environmental impact statement is required. And that is that means that additional environmental review is required at that point. So next slide, please. So in slide 15, under NEPA and the National Environmental Policy Act, we use the term proposed actions and alternatives, and we're going to define those here. So in the proposed action, DOE is proposing to provide funding to the University of Maine to support the development of the New England Aqua Ventus 1 project. And these actions include the design, construction, and commissioning of the proposed project, along with environmental monitoring and up to 5 years of post construction, structural, and performance monitoring data collection. The operation, maintenance, and the eventual decommissioning of the project will also be analyzed in the environmental assessment, since those are considered connected actions. In addition to the proposed action, the alternatives would also be evaluated in the environmental assessment. And that would include a power and fiber optic cable to Monhegan Island, which you know is an option that is currently being considered by residents of the island as part of a community benefit agreement, and also in a no-action alternative. And this is a no-action alternative is always looked at in the environmental review process. And that would be an alternative in which DOE would not provide funding in support of the development of the Aqua Ventus project. Next slide, please. So based on our current understanding of the project, we've identified some initial environmental resources that will be reviewed under the draft environmental assessment. This is one of the areas that we would like to have your input on. So if you have a concern or issue related to any environmental resource area, please submit it to DOE for consideration in the form of a written comment. So this list on this slide is not intended to be an all-inclusive list. It's just to provide a framework for some of the resources that we'll start looking at. Next slide, please. So you might be wondering how to submit a comment for consideration in the environmental assessment or the draft environmental assessment. And there are several options for submitting your written comment. Right there at this meeting tonight, you can submit a comment on a comment card. Where you can have that card to fill that out. There's also a laptop computer that you can type in your comments. You can also submit an email to the electronic mailbox that we have set up for the draft environmental assessment. And you certainly can also submit that as well through the U.S. Postal Mail as well. And all of these options are listed on the last slide of the presentation with all the addresses. Next slide, please. So to summarize how you can be involved within the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act process, we certainly encourage everyone to ask questions. There's representatives on site there from the Department of Energy as well as the University of Maine to answer your questions and also accept your comments. Again, the date, March 22nd, is the deadline that we are asking for your comments to be submitted in writing that will allow us to incorporate those comments into the draft environmental assessment. And we certainly want you to stay involved. So if you'd like to be notified of upcoming meetings, you can provide your name and address on one of the comment cards there, or you can send an email to that web address there, aquaventus1ea@ee.doe.gov. And then certainly keep checking the DOE website for updates. This is where the draft environmental assessment will be posted. And that is the website there, www.energy.gov/node/2053718. So that is the environmental review process. And I think Lori had a few more points that she wanted to make.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you. On the website there, Aquaventus One, I just wanted to point out, when we set up this mailbox up a few months ago, it ended up with a number one, not a Roman numeral one. So if you type in the Roman numeral one, it's not going to make it. So please use the number one, or you can use the link that's on the DOE webpage and just click, and it'll enter that email address for you. And then there's also an automatic notification set up on the mailbox, so you'll get a receipt that your comment was submitted or your question was received. So just be aware of that. So if you don't get that automatic reply, then you would want to make sure you resubmit it
so that it makes sure it's going to the right address. Does that make sense?
Along with that, Diana talked about the project description. And those of you that may not be real familiar with the NEPA process, that's kind of the key document. In the NEPA environmental review world, you have to have a project description very detailed so that you know what you're analyzing. So that's what the purpose of the project description is. And in there, there may be some new information that you may not have been aware of. And part of that is because of NEPA, you want to consider all possibilities at the beginning. And so you kind of start with a bounding analysis, and then we can start to really hone in on the actual details. And Jake's going to go a little more into the probably the new information a lot of you weren't aware of, is I had in the project description, I wrote in a scenario where there would be a larger turbine. So we'd like to explain that to you tonight. So that's a really not the most likely way that this project's going to look, but it's certainly a possibility with advances in technology. So we wanted to be upfront at the start of this process and make sure we're capturing all these little nuances so that you know exactly what Department of Energy is proposing to fund. So that's why that project description is really the key document for you to understand what the DOE is proposing to fund. And then also with that, along with the environmental review process, Alana mentioned it, but there's different budget or performance periods for this project. And there's a lot of go, no-go decisions that DOE will go through based on if the university is meeting the milestones that DOE is requiring them to meet. So those are just kind of some of the little nuances if you're not familiar with NEPA, and then also our financial assistance process. So we'll take more questions on that. I'll turn it over to Jake now to talk about that project description.
So quickly, and I know almost everybody knows more about this than I do probably. And I'm sorry, I got a little bit of cold. We are talking about demonstration scale offshore wind facility in the test site, 2.5 miles south of Monhegan. We are focused on a 2 6-megawatt turbine project. One of the footnotes that we talked about was potential for 8 megawatts is really that the turbine manufacturers right now are doing improvements to the turbine designs. They're improving output through control systems. So, for example, the 2014-13 Siemens turbine that we originally looked at was a 6-megawatt turbine. It's now an 8-megawatt turbine. It is the exact same size, the exact same rotor, everything about it. But today we are focused on a 6-megawatt turbine. All the design and engineering of the platform, everything about that is consistent with what we've been talking about right along. The reason we included that in the project description is that the turbine manufacturer comes back to us and says, the one you wanted in 2016 is now something different in 2019. We need to be able to take the scope of that. But the platform itself, everything's designed around a 6-megawatt turbine. Those dimensions are pretty close to being locked in, so there's not going to be a major size difference or rotor difference or anything like that. The overall location of the project, which just remember, and that's why this is in the EA, construction up in Hamden, Hughes Brothers Concrete Facility, that's where the concrete foundations are built. They're towed down to Searsport, Mack Point, where they meet up with turbines and blades that are shipped in off the dock there. It's more to the dock, and then pick and place. Big crane puts the turbines on top, puts the blades on. Once that's all done, they're fully commissioned there, and that means all the electrical systems, everything's tested before they can then we actually would take ownership. Towed out to Monhegan, Monhegan Island, and the anchors would be pre-installed, the electrical cables pre-installed, and they're hooked up ready to go. Also, right now we're exploring this, what we hope is the near final route. That's part of the EA process, is to look at the cable route. So in order to get permission and to use DOE funding to do the survey of the cable route, that's part of this whole process. So the cable route we're looking at goes from Mohegan to primarily within the charted cableway to Port Clyde. and then looking at several landing spots in Port Clyde where it would connect into the Central Maine Power grid infrastructure and go into the grid. This is just an example of the turbine assembly. I already talked about that. In the event that, because they're floating floating turbines, in the event that there's any need to do any repair or replacement of parts or anything, there's a possibility that it could be towed back into Sears Port for turbine replacement. Turbine and performance data, as was said in the A, that's the performance of the data, the technical, the engineering is up to 5 years. That's part of the DOE grant, and you would intend to monitor that for the duration of the project, and then potentially operate this up for 20 years. That's consistent with our power purchase agreement. The general dimensions are, I mean, I think we've gone through this before, but again, they're on the pictures, they're on the thing. So 490 feet rotor diameter. The tip, top tip of the blade is about 576 feet above the water. We do have ballast control in here, so adjusting the level above the water is still in a ballasting issue. Right now, that is 44 feet above the water and 66 feet below the water. It does get towed out at a higher draft because the dock in Sears Port is about 35 feet of water, so it gets towed out at a little bit of a higher draft. Then it's set down once we get there. The diameter of the base today, as we speak, is 301 feet. So 115 foot radius. This is a picture that demonstrates how the two cables would be connected, the turbines to turbine cable. There's still design issues in here, but generally speaking, we have what's called a lazy S. So there's a cable that goes to shore or to Monhegan. There's a floating section that allows the turbine to move up and down. This section is allows the turbine to move up and down or within the watch circle of the mooring system. These are connected by to the ground through mooring chains that go off of each one of the three columns. They go to a ground anchor. What's being designed for the Monhegan site is the plow anchor. There's some pictures of those around here that gets plowed into the dirt. The cable, in this case, is a 12-megawatt cable to match the load of the turbines that's required under the state permitting. It's about a 5.5-inch diameter cable based on the current specification. Obviously, that could grow a little bit, but not much, based on armoring and things like that and what the cable vendor returns. The cables, the way we have it designed now, and Dick Hall's in the back, so I'm going to steal his thunder a little bit, is that there'd be a 6-megawatt cable, a 6-megawatt cable that goes to a junction, and a 12-megawatt that goes to the wind. And then again, the cable landing locations right now, export cable to Port Clyde, goes to a landfall. CMP plans to rebuild the power line to Port Clyde back to the substation. That requires replacing poles and being able to put the this cable up above the others. On Monhegan Island, as you know, we have offered the cable option, which is a cable to from the turbines to Monhegan, and then Monhegan to the mainland. We are evaluating this based on running in the existing cableway and making it potentially making a landing at Dead Man's Cove, and then running from Dead Man's Cove to the power district. We've been talking to the power district to explain to us and understand with their lawyers what the technical feasibility or the legal feasibility of using that route is right now. And so using that as the base case of, you know, if that can't work, are there any alternative landing spots? I will say that the cable on and any case, Dick can answer this more specifically, has to meet current code and standards for installation. So that also takes into consideration how deep things are buried, what kind of poles, any of that type of activity, transformers, and all that to keep the water. The current specs. I'm good, right?
Is that on?
Yep.
Muted?
Nope, you're good.
Jake, do you just have the road written wrong on there? I kept saying lobster boat road on that slide.
Is that Devon's
code? Yeah, probably. I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
Nope. One of our maps
that picked up somewhere does color
lobster.
The road down there.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's going to
lobster
code road's the other
It's
road.
On the other end, right?
Yeah.
We'll fix that.
That's how we come out.
No, yeah. Actually, we're going to dig that road up for cable.
No, thank you very much. Good catch. Okay, so the next, move past this slide, you'll see again at the end. We had some late additions to our presentation, so now we're going to move to the next slide.
Yes, we're going to Jason.
Yeah, I think it's Bob first. Can't remember. What's the next slide?
Yeah,
so next we'll have Robert Marvany with the state office.
Conservation, Forestry, and Agriculture.
Yeah, Conservation, Forestry, and Agriculture. Thank you. As soon as we get him unmuted and get his slides started. Okay. All right, Bob, you're on.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, good. So I'm just going to very briefly review the siting process that we went through in 2009. So if you go to the next slide. So this process was laid out in legislation that passed our legislature unanimously in June of 2009, and it established the siting requirements for the offshore test sites. And it directed my department and the state planning office to work together to to identify potential sites offshore. And it required that we have a series of public meetings and gave us a deadline of December of 2009 to complete the process. Next, please. Back one. There. So among the criteria that was in the legislation were these. First, that it has to be within Maine's coastal waters. So that's no more than 3 miles off the farthest islands offshore. So that's the Maine's territorial waters where Maine can control the permitting process. The next requirement was that it had to be deep water, at least around 200 feet or more, and have very high annual wind speeds, 17 miles per hour or more, and also to avoid navigation channels and obstructions. Now, we used just these. There are a whole bunch of other criteria, which I'll get to shortly, but we used just these four to make a first cut at where on the coast of Maine it might be possible to have one of these test sites. And the next slide shows a map. So using just those four criteria, the orange areas shown on this map are the only ones that meet those four. So already pretty limiting in terms of Maine state waters where all of those criteria overlap to identify potential testing sites. So we used at this step, we then basically went to meetings, what we called scoping meetings and public meetings, first with small groups of fishermen, with communities, and then with larger groups to get feedback. If we go to the next slide. The next slide shows that we had these eight areas, and we collected additional information on all these other parameters or resource concerns in all of these areas. For much of it, we used existing information on what we knew about marine mammals, for example, and deep water ports, obviously, and what we knew about the geology of the bottom in these areas. But we wanted to get more information from the communities, from interested parties on many of these other aspects, in particular where fishermen use the bottom. We know, for example, that there's no acre on the bottom of the of Maine state waters that isn't used for something. So the intent was to look at all of these and try to minimize the impacts. Next slide. So we held 25 what we called scoping meetings. These are meetings with different fishermen groups along the whole coast of Maine and different communities. We came to Monhegan on two occasions to meet with the fishermen and then with the community. We held five larger regional public meetings on the mainland from Wells all the way up to Machias that were well attended, and we gave an overview, provided what we knew about resources and got feedback. So we got feedback from all of these meetings, and we used those to identify smaller actual test areas, the demonstration test sites. And we released those drafts in late October of 2009. There was a 30-day comment period, and we used those comments to further refine the sites. And then the final sites were selected in December of 2009. And next slide, please. Here's just a picture from our meeting out on Monhegan in August. We met with a number of fishermen. I think there were 8 fishermen there at our meeting. And then later we had a meeting with about 20 participants in October, I think at the same place you're meeting right now. Next, please. So when we went to these scoping meetings, for example, meeting with the fishermen in August, we brought a map like this. We brought maps like this and asked the fishermen to identify areas where it would really be a problem to for them, for their activities, to have wind test sites, and then areas where it was less of an issue. So we got a fair amount of feedback. I know a number of fishermen participated and marked areas on the map that were bad I wouldn't say areas that were good, but areas that were less bad. And so we collected all this information plus other information from the regional meetings to make final decisions as to which sites would be identified for offshore wind testing. Next slide, please. So that's how we got to this final site off of Monhegan. And there are three sites that were finalized in this process. One is off of Boone Island, one is off of Damerscove Island, and then this site on Monhegan. And we worked with the University of Maine and discussed all these options with them, and they felt that the Monhegan site met their objectives best for deep water opportunities and high wind speeds. So that's why this site got designated as the university's research site, although those two others still exist as demonstration sites as well. So the last slide just has my contact info. So you can call me or send me an email, and I'll be happy to respond to any questions now or later. Thanks.
Questions for a little bit, Bob, if you're still available. Can't remember if you had a time conflict. It's already a little late. Are you still be available for a while?
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay, thank you. So everybody get the info. We can put this slide back up too. My plan is to post the complete presentation probably first thing in the morning, so it will be on the DOE webpage. The posters are already there for your use, but we'll get this final presentation up there too sometime tomorrow. Thank you. Okay, so next we have Jay Clement with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and he's going to talk a little bit about the permitting process that this proposed project would need to go through with his agency. John?
Okay, good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, and so your first slide up is permit authorities?
Yes.
Thank you. So a permit, several permits will be required for the project. One from the Corps of Engineers, representing the federal end of things, and then certainly one from the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, which will rope in a number of state agencies under the state permit process. But on the federal level, the Corps' jurisdiction focuses on three key statutes: Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899, Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, and then the last one, Section 103 of the Marine Protection Research and Sanctuaries Act. It's really only the first two that come into play here, because there's really no dredging and disposal of material per se associated with this project. And of the two that are listed up above, the key one is the top one, the Rivers and Harbors Act, because that regulates work in navigable waters. Navigable waters in the state of Maine are all tidal waters. Doesn't matter if they drain completely at low water, if they're subject to the ebb and flow of the tide, there, any work in those waters requires a Corps permit. Work includes any number of things. It can be dredging, filling, piers, pilings, moorings, aquaculture operations. You name it, if it's done in navigable waters, particularly if structures are involved, then a Corps permit is required. Under the Clean Water Act, specifically Section 404, a Corps permit is required for the discharge of dredged or fill material into all waters, so not only navigable waters, the tidal ones, but also your inland lakes, ponds, rivers, streams, and their associated wetlands. So if we switch to the next slide, more specifically how that relates to this project, obviously the tower installations, the transmission line coming into the island and then into the mainland, the work associated with the installation of that transmission line, whether it's plowing or jetting or armoring somehow with anchor material, and but also the work that's done on the inland side of things by CMP or others to upgrade existing pole lines, upgrade existing structures. If waterway or wetland fill is required to facilitate that construction, all of that work will come under a common application to the Corps, and that's what we'll be reviewing. There are some things that we don't get involved in. Unlike the DEP, we don't get involved if you're adjacent to a resource. Either you're in it or you're not. So there are going to be some things that the state is involved in that we are not, and probably vice versa. We have several different ways of permitting a project. The most common is called a general permit, and it's the most abbreviated of the two processes, but it's designed for projects of fairly low to minimal environmental navigational impact, as well as low controversy. And I think most folks would agree that this project is going to be large enough and has enough facets and enough concerns and interests raised by any number of folks that it really, at least our position right now, is that it won't go the general permit route. So it'll go through our individual permit process, which is our more complex, most time-consuming process, allows for the most amount of public participation and full review by the Corps. Next slide. So the process, in summary, an application is received, we review it for completeness, we're obligated to put out a public notice in which we solicit written public comment on the project. We evaluate those comments along with input from state and federal resource agencies. We may or may not decide to have a public hearing. And then we conduct what's called a public interest review, and listed in the large orange block are a number of the things we look at. Certainly under the Rivers and Harbors Act, the key thing we're looking at is navigation. What will be the effect of the towers, the anchoring systems, the cables, et cetera, on existing navigational uses in an area. And then under the Clean Water Act, that's really where we're looking at a lot of the environmental factors. What will the installations, be it the cable or the anchoring systems or what have you, or the operations of the operation of the entire facility have on a whole host of environmental resources, endangered species, bird species, mammal species, marine mammals, aquatic species, benthic species, you name it, it's probably fair game to be considered under this public interest review. But really the bread and butter and our key focus will be on navigation. We share that role with the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard will be a player. So, and speaking of that, if we switch to the final slide, which I have to too, you can see that there will be a whole host of folks that are going to get a crack at this project, either through the DOE process or our process or both. They are federal agencies like EPA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, Soil Conservation Service, Coast Guard, Interior, Indian Affairs, Historic, DOE, obviously, FEMA, Congress. You know, the congressional delegation was represented yesterday, and they will continue to show interest in the project. At the state level, you have a number of similar folks, but at a state level, the DEP, Department of Marine Resources, IF&W, Parks and Lands, Historic Preservation, tribal interests, state planning, the legislature, of course. But then on the local level, obviously the citizens groups. The citizen groups are no less important to the process, and I think some would argue are perhaps even more important to the process in some cases. But you also have riparian property owners, land trusts, fishermen co-ops, planning boards, et cetera, that play a role in our review. Then there are a whole host of other kind of non-governmental type groups like Audubon or Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, Maine Coast Heritage Trust that all have the opportunity and have in fact at one time or another for various projects weighed in and made their concerns or interests known one way or the other. And all of that mishmash of acronyms and agencies and groups feeds this NEPA process that DOE is involved in. The Corps is another federal agency, and we are just as obligated to consider NEPA as DOE is. They have to for their funding process, we have to for our permitting process, but in the interest of good government, we try to mirror up or marry up, if you will, the NEPA needs of DOE and our NEPA needs so that we're not going through this process a whole bunch of times. So you will see an attempt, or there will be an attempt as this process moves forward, to tie together various milestones that the Corps has and that DOE has. For example, when the draft EA goes out, that may be the logical time where the Corps goes out with its public notice, and that way we're soliciting public comment within the same time frame, and folks that are commenting to DOE can also be commenting to the Corps and vice versa. And that, again, that's just good government and makes for as efficient a process as possible. The permitting is quite some time away. The applicant, in this case, UMaine and various partners, have a lot of work to do. A lot of baseline information still to gather. There's information to be gathered about the whole construction of the cofferdam facility up in Hamden. There's information to be gathered as to whether upgrades to the Searsport terminal have to occur in order to facilitate this. So there's a lot of work still to be done before I expect an application to be rolling in the door, and then substantial permitting process to occur after it does. But I think DOE put up a slide or will at some point that speaks to the role of the public. And I think that slide's very similar to one I've used in the past, and it's really critical that you stay informed, that you be aware of the timelines, that you share information with all of the agencies so that we're all on the same sheet of music, and obviously that you don't be silent. And the worst decisions that the federal government or state government for that matter can make are those that are made in a vacuum without the benefit of public and other input. So you have a big role in the process, and we look forward to hearing from you. So I will stop at that point and answer questions later if there are any.
Thank you, Jay, for your time. So now we'll transition to the question and answer phase. So those that are participating remotely, you should be able to submit a question via the chat button. So maybe what we can do is alternate between a remote question if they come in and then with folks here in the room. Can you set up there?
Yep.
Okay. Okay. All right, let's start in the room. That's the first question. Yes.
I just want to first thank you for coming out and making this presentation and listening. My question is, how common is it to cite a major wind turbine next to a national landmark?
I'll repeat the question. If Alana, did you have a hard time hearing that? It's not for you. I'm just trying to gauge.
Yeah, I caught the very tail end. I mean, I didn't catch the very tail end, which I think is when the question was actually asked.
Okay. So let me paraphrase, and if I misspeak, please correct me. So first, you thank us for being here, and then your question is, how common is it for a wind farm to be sited next to a national landmark? And as far as the environmental review site, I don't have a handy statistic for you. National landmarks along with historic properties are something that are considered during the environmental review process, and they will definitely be considered here. And along with that, we have to comply with the National Historic Preservation Act. There are certain protections given to lighthouses. So all of that will be captured during our environmental review process. But if you have a specific concern, I would really encourage you to please, knowing that we will be doing that, but if there is a specific, you could please submit that. Thank you. So, I mean, we try to learn. I live in Colorado, so we try to learn through site visits, through our project partners, through other federal, state, and local agencies, and then from you guys, what is out there that we may not be aware of. So this is really your opportunity to help us to make sure we don't miss something important. I'd rather know up front so we can analyze it through the process, work with you, work with the State Historic Preservation Office on any impacts and that type of thing. So thank you for your question. Anything, nothing from remote?
Yeah.
Alana, maybe you could submit something to make sure it's working remotely. Are you set up to do that? All right, next.
You are received.
Yes. I have a question for Jace.
Yeah.
A buzz went around today that the turbines, or at least one of them, might be as high as 600. So it's a change in height and also a change in the amount of power that it put out. And I just wondered, is that a buzz? Is it a possibility? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so
let me repeat the question. So just so everyone on the phone heard, and please, if I mistake, correct me. So there was a buzz going around today that there's turbines as high as 600
feet in height, and I didn't get the power, and different power,
more power than
what you were aware of.
Yeah.
And is this really a possibility?
It seems to be another change. So
another change.
Yeah. So as I tried to answer before, what we were reflecting on is in the project description, they included the qualifier that the turbine size could be 6 to 8 megawatts, and that the size could increase, I think it's 10 to 15%, I don't have it right in front of me. Again, what that was to put in to make sure that covered any bases and anything that might change. The reality is that we are staying with the 6 megawatt turbine and the heights that are on there right now. That's the design that we're pursuing right now. There is no change in that. As I said before, some of the turbine manufacturers are trying to upgrade their turbines internally to increase the power out of the same turbines. So as an example, Siemens increased their 6 megawatt to 8 megawatt, no blade diameter change, no height diameter change, no weight diameter change. So right now we're looking at a 6 megawatt turbine that has 150 meter rotor diameter. The heights that are listed on that turbines are the heights that everything is being designed to. Yeah, up there. Sorry, I was looking at supposed to.
And Alana, you in particular, if you have any information that would be beneficial, please feel free to chime in.
Yeah, I mean, all I would say is to echo something that Jake just said in terms of turbine technology. Siemens, I know that the University of Maine project is intending on using the 6 megawatt GE turbine. And in speaking to the GE representative, I haven't heard anything that indicates that an upgrade is imminent, but those things typically happen quickly and quietly within the companies. And then they come out and say, our turbine now can produce 7 megawatts instead of 6 megawatts. That happened with Siemens. About 4 years ago, they came out with a 6 megawatt turbine. And in the last 2 years, they've upgraded that turbine from being 6 megawatts to 7 megawatts and then to 8 megawatts. The physical machine, the physical measurements of the machine didn't change, but what changed were the control systems and a couple of the internal parts. But the 6 megawatt and 8 megawatt Siemens machines look physically the same. They just perform differently. And so that's something that could potentially happen with the GE turbine, which is why in the project description, there's that envelope range to make sure that if the nameplate of the turbine changes in capacity, that it's covered under the environmental assessment. Otherwise, the process, Lori, please correct me if I'm wrong, would have to be completed again or amended in some way.
Yeah, that's correct, and that was a great question. Thank you. That's the main reason we added the potential change in turbine size. There are some things out of the university's control and also out of DOE's control, and this is one of them. If the turbine manufacturer was to upgrade to a higher megawatt, we have a question remotely, and then I'll come over there. Did that get to your answer?
Yes. Okay. I have one little tag.
Okay, go ahead.
With the larger megawatts, would that require anything different with this?
I'm not sure everybody heard. So the follow-on question would, if the turbine was upgraded to a larger megawatt, would that impact the base of the turbine or the foundation, I believe,
that you're getting at?
The size of the base is directly related to the weight, the mass that's up there. So if they're not changing the mass, it doesn't require any changes to the base. If the mass of the turbine gets bigger, and that's what I mean, the electrical generation parts, all that, not the blades and all that, if the mass of that were to get bigger, then that would, we'd have to reflect that in the base. But like the Siemens one, the mass, because everything is the same, so there wouldn't be any change.
But the last bullet says foundations would be 10 to 20% larger for 8 megawatts.
Yeah,
because they made us say that.
That's what I'm saying. It's CYA for sure, right? It is the current design is that GE turbine, that mass, everything about that. We are so far down that path that it would be it would be worse than anything else to not do that, right? If you wanted to start up from scratch with an 8-megawatt turbine that was 20% heavier, then those dimensions would have to change to do that. That is not the point.
But the trend, and Alana, you can speak to that again, is to get a larger megawatt of a smaller turbine blade. So that's why we did a little bit larger based on how they are today. But if they did upgrade to the 8-megawatt, it would, like, in several years from now, it could basically be the same size. Is that the understanding? I'll say that real clear.
Based on weights and loads, base has to be big enough to support the load up there.
Okay.
If it's the same loads, then it's the same.
So, Josh, can you read the question?
Sure. So an individual named Cliff has said, has there been any concern expressed regarding the tourist attraction these turbines will represent? Is Monhegan prepared to accommodate an increase in visitation?
Sounds like a question for you all. Does anyone have a response or similar?
The ferry's going to carry so many people.
Yeah. So, Cliff, thank you very much for your question. I would really encourage you, if you have the concern related to increased tourism, that you specifically submit a comment on that. And if we didn't quite understand, please clarify. Okay.
My question was answered.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Chris Rollins. I just had a question about decibels.
Okay.
And if this is experimental, do they really know how many decibels are going to be generated, especially over water? Us who live here know how you can hear someone speaking across the water from a great distance away. And it's the low decibels that I understand are the more that penetrate further into your house when you're in at night. You can't hear the wind, but I hear you. I guess you can hear the thumping of the blades. So how much is that going to affect us? Do you really know the sound out there? Not too far away.
Alana, were you able to, I'll answer that question, but were you able to hear it, or do I need to repeat it?
I think it's worth repeating, Lori. I hear it. It was a little bit.
Okay.
But it may be worth just repeating.
Yes. The question was related to the noise, the decibels. If this is really experimental, do we know what the noise levels will be? As we all know, those people that live near the water or recreation on the water, we know that sound travels very far, and particularly concerned to low decibels that penetrate farther. So, yes, that is a great question. I don't have an answer for you today. That is an area that we will be analyzing in the environmental assessment. And just to make sure, it would really help if you did submit that too. I'd like to get that on there. But that is definitely something we are aware of. There are noise studies that you can do, modeling and things like that. We're not quite to that point, so I can't answer what those would be. And I know the university has done some studies, and I can let you speak to that, but DOE at this point is not, at least the NEPA team has not vetted any of the studies or the data that the university has pulled together. So that's something, as we start the EA process, we gather all the data that's there. Are there gaps that we need to do additional studies? We kind of go down that path. We consult with our federal and state partners that may have experts in that area. So we pull all that together. So I do know Jake can speak to what the university has done to date, but I've not validated that data yet. So the next time we come out for a meeting, when the draft EA is available, then that's after we've gone through that whole process and we're comfortable with the data and what the impacts will be. So I can't speak to it today. Great question.
So my just follow-up is really a question for you, and I think you answered it, which is, but for everybody's help.
Yes.
Is that we have done a certain amount of baseline studies. We are projecting to do more studies.
Yeah.
But basically, you got NEPA will look at what we've done and make the recommendations of whether what we've proposed is enough to do the additional or what additional studies we need to do.
Correct.
So anything going forward will only be after NEPA says this is what makes sense going forward.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And so yeah, there's it'd be quite the process, very very involved. So if that wasn't clear, please ask more questions.
I have a question about that actually.
Yeah.
So
if I can just briefly interrupt, we received a comment that folks are having a hard time hearing questions are asked. So if we can use loud voices as best as can, that would be great.
Can they hear me repeating them?
That's
interesting. Okay. So you just said that you would vet all the studies that they did and then say new studies need to be done. And then, so you go back to the University of Maine and say, you need to complete these certain studies. So some people in the past have been a little bit concerned or skeptical that the studies done by the university mm-hmm. are valid studies if they're the ones wanting to do projects.
Sure.
So how does putting it, the studies back to them put people at ease on
okay.
that front?
Sure. So the question was again about studies such as noise studies, and it was acknowledged that the university has done some baseline studies, but there is some concern about maybe how thorough those were done or how complete. And so the question was really about the DOE process again for ensuring that that is valid information. Is that pressure?
Yeah.
That was a longer way.
Yeah.
So, again, we'll be working with our partner agencies and our subject matter experts as we draft the EA. And part of that process is to review not only the information the university has put together, other organizations, like when you're talking about bird impacts, we look at Audubon studies and things like that. So we'll be pulling in all these various resources and summarizing them in the document. And then once I am comfortable and my legal team is comfortable, that's when we feel like we have sufficient evidence that's been validated, reviewed by our experts, that we're comfortable with issuing that draft EA for the public to review. So then it will be your turn to then see if that is a reasonable amount of information, if it makes sense to you, and then you'll have an opportunity to then question the validity of the data from your viewpoint and the analysis and the results. You know, whether we think it's a short-term impact, long-term impact, that's all fair game at that point for you guys to then be comfortable with. Sorry, I'm being very wordy tonight for some reason. I'm getting thirsty. One, for those of you that don't get motion sickness, one of the bad side effects that dries you out big time. So I've been drinking a lot of water this afternoon. So are we okay? Josh is fiddling, so we're all right?
Fiddle away.
Okay. So we're working with speakers. Is there any other question? Folks are commenting that they can't really hear, so we're working on the microphones and speakers. Is there another question, Josh, or
a comment? I think it's just important to repeat the statements.
Okay.
As they're made.
Okay, so yes.
If your answers aren't long, they're content rich.
Okay, good.
So rich that my tired brain did not actually get the
okay.
answer I was hoping for.
Sure.
Yeah, so is there the potential that DOE would do its own independent studies of areas that are of concern, or is it a matter of your assessing the studies that UNH has already
right.
done, giving everybody your take on that?
Right.
So would new studies be done potentially,
okay.
or is it
by DOE
your analysis that work is already
okay.
done?
So the question was, would DOE conduct independent studies? Was part one. So let me address that. We are not set up to do an independent study, but we provide the direction to University of Maine and their project partners. So we would review things like study protocols, and that would also be, if it's something to do with like avian, we would be working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the development of those types of studies. So, and then your second part, I didn't quite
talk. Oh no, it was hard for you to remember that. That was my second part.
It's hard.
Just because there's potential for DOE to do its own independent studies. It sounds like the answer to that is,
oh, no. We would not do our own independent unless, Alana, you're aware of some funding. So on the NEPA side, DOE, we typically don't do our own studies. We would require, like, if the university doesn't have expertise, then we would require them to go out and basically obtain that expertise. Can you talk to that, Alana?
So I'm sorry, Lori, I was trying to unmute my phone, and then I missed the first part of the question. I think the question was about whether DOE had funding to do additional environmental studies.
Correct. And so normally under the NEPA umbrella, we work with the project recipient, and they have the responsibility. We review their projects, their study plans, and then also work with resource agencies to vet those plans with their experts. At this time, I mean, DOE does fund a lot of research per se. And I mean, one of the things Alana's team is funding is some meteorological buoys, that type of thing for data collection. We also are funding.
Right. So,
go ahead.
Lori, I'll just speak to it really, really quickly. And the unfortunate answer is because we do not have a congressionally approved fiscal year 2017 budget, we can't officially do any new starts on any new projects. We don't have any current environmental studies that we're doing specifically to offshore wind at this time with an approved budget. We could potentially do some studies, but it has to obviously conform with what we're congressionally directed to do.
So I think in going back to your question, I think it was a conflict of interest that you're concerned with. So yeah, obviously University of Maine has their ownership of this project. And so how can we trust the data that they're collecting, that they're not biased, that type of thing? So that's where DOE does come in. And we work, as I said, with resource agencies and their experts to review all that material. And so we are very involved in it to make sure that that conflict is not happening. So it's really up, it is up to Department of Energy to vet that data. It's a great question, but please, you know, feel free to submit that as a comment. Yes, sir.
I have a two-part factual question.
Okay.
What is the cost of the proposed cable to the mainland, and what is its projected lifespan?
Okay, so the two-part question was, what is the cost of the proposed cable to the mainland, and what is its proposed life expectation, projected lifespan of that cable to the mainland?
Yes.
I can answer the second half. The projected life of cables is 25 years. That's the typical life that the cable manufacturer will give us. If it's properly installed and properly maintained, 25 years is the typical life. With regard to the costs, we're hoping to get any sort of a firm cost at all, we need a subsea survey. Because the cable manufacturers can give us basically a wild guess until they know what the bottom is, and they can't give us a firm price. We're trying to prepare for a survey in late spring, early summer right now. So at that point, our process will be to get a subsea survey, and we'll submit that survey to a group of cable manufacturers, them for best pricing available for the cables that are necessary. So we, if the island makes the decision to stop on the island, that would be the cable which would come from Port Clyde to Monteagan and the second cable to Monteagan to the service. They choose not to go that route. If we get a decision by the time we get pricing, we just get a price for cable direct.
And Josh, you typed in that response.
Yep.
So that folks participating remotely were able to hear. Is there any questions coming in remotely?
We're good.
Okay. Next.
This question, I guess, would be for you also. What is the expected maintenance schedule of a cable of that length and size?
Usually what they're, and again, it's dependent upon the cable being hired in the morning. Usually what they do is, a year after it's installed, they do an inspection of the cable. And then at that point, they set up an inspection frequency that is either 3 or 5 years, where they inspect the whole cable. Now, that's a physical inspection with, you know, some sort of a remote operated vehicle to actually walk along the cable. There's constant monitoring of the performance of the cable, because one of the beauties of having the fiber optics at both ends is you know what you're producing at the turbines, and you know what you're receiving at the other end or receiving in Monteagan. And so you can detect the degradation over time, or even a very quick degradation in the performance. And if you have that kind of a degradation, you would have immediate response to go inspect and figure out what's going on.
And can I ask one more question that relates
yes.
to that? So a regular maintenance schedule costs something? Does it cost the university or MAV or Geegan something to inspect it?
Yeah, the owner of the cable has to put that bill. You can tie it into the purchase price, and the manufacturer can include that as a service over time. But in most cases, that's done by the owner of the cable.
I'm giving Josh a little time to finish typing. He's
minute.
I'm impressed with your typing skills. Okay. I think the lady in green had, and then we'll come to you.
You were this has to do with the cable.
Okay.
When it comes ashore.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what are its requirements in terms of either buried or alcoholic or whatever? What has to happen to it?
Okay. We have to meet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. First thing, it has to be engineered to say. Okay. So we have to meet the international electrical code. And we have to need to maintain electrical pumps. So those are the minimum we have. Okay. Typically, that would mean that you would bury a cable a certain depth. And depending on what the outside of the cable is, but generally, you're putting it 2 feet underground as a minimum. The other way is if you put it overhead, then it has to be a certain height above the ground. And that height is dependent upon two things. One is the voltage, and then the second is what the uses of the area are under the cable. Okay. So, for example, as it crosses a road, I think it's 30 feet, it has to be above, because there's potential that somebody could do this. But if you're through the woods, you have to look at whether motorized vehicles go into the woods, and four-wheelers or snow machines or whatever. That would be one height. You have to look at whether horseback riding is done in the woods, or if you only have walking, then that can be the lowest number. And all of those are set by code. Okay. And everything we do, we are registered professional engineers, so we have to certify that it's all done by code.
To take pity on Josh, you're typing Could you, since there seems to be a lot of questions, could you move up here closer to the microwave? Or the microwave. The microphone.
Okay. I had one more. Okay. Basically, what do you have?
There's my hair.
Which you may know or Jake may know, I'm not sure. And do you have a potential route for that cable?
Offshore or onshore?
If it comes up through Dead Man's Cove.
I mean, Dead Man's Cove is what we're looking at is an option to be looking at. We don't yet have permission to use Dead Man's Cove. We don't, as Jake said, that there's work being done with Monhegan Plantation Power District to determine what the rules are for right-of-way and what's going on there. Okay. And then we would have to look at any landowners along the way. And I know one of the landowners along the way of one of the routes that the cable is shown on the picture, he's saying, well, nobody ever talked to me. But that's part of the process. We first have to make the decision, is it going to come to Monhegan? And then we have to work with the folks here at Monhegan to decide where the route is.
All right. Your turn.
It's for you again. Just another.
Figure. Did you like my chair?
No. Table question. When I hear people who seem to work with cables and understand cables, and I understand there's a lot of them around now, and that if they're properly installed, then there's a whole procedure for putting them properly. They can last way longer than the warranty period. This 25 years you mentioned, is that the warranty period the manufacturer is?
That's what's called the rated life.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the expectation is that, I can't remember whether it's 80% or 90% of kids will operate flawlessly for the expected life. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or the rated life, whichever you want to call it. Yes, many cables last a lot longer than that. There are many cables in the waters of the state of Maine that have lasted longer than that. But there are also many cables that have gotten hooked or snagged or whatever and have had many repairs along the way.
But that's catastrophic without some sort of catastrophic thing, just general deterioration.
Yeah, I've heard the biggest deterioration that we're hearing from cable manufacturers is related to improper insulation. The cables move on the seabed and scrape against the rock and scour away. That's the most common mode of failure of cables. And that's all about properly installed.
So would the cable manufacturer be insured? Would they insure their cable and what's that procedure?
That's all dependent upon how you buy it, okay? You know, when you purchase a cable, it's a contract, and you're looking at that contract for life. And as with any major investment, there may be insurance associated with it, there may be bonding associated with it, there may be guarantees associated with it, until you actually get into the conversation with the cable manufacturer and install. I can't answer all those details. I would guess a lot of that would be included in that contract.
But the underwriters would be in on the process of examining and overseeing the way.
Absolutely.
So if it's a properly installed cable and they've vetted the whole procedure from beginning to end, then they're more apt to pick up the insurance.
Oh yeah. I mean, and the rates of insurance are always dependent upon what risk they assign. The more information and the better prepared, the lower the risk.
Thank you.
All right. Do any of my subject matter experts have any last thoughts while we're waiting to make questions?
We'll need them to
send them
a message. Yeah, just send a message if you do. Certainly last. Okay, we've got one a question. The question is if we had anything to do with the wind turbines off of Block Island. And is there information related to them that we would be able to use in our process? The to my knowledge, and Alana, you might correct me, Department of Energy was not involved in the Block Island.
That's correct. DOE was not involved in the Block Island project. However, it's now about 2010-2011. There was some involvement with DOE in and DOI in the Rhode Island marine spatial planning exercises that went into determining where the Block Island project was going, but the that was the extent of our involvement there.
Okay. The information though that's publicly available, especially for offshore wind farms, is something that we look at when we're gathering our volumes of data. So that's definitely something, if there's available data, that we will be looking at. Thank you. That was a great question.
Can I just comment on that?
Yes.
The turbine that Block Island is using is a 6 megawatt GE LEI turbine, and that is the turbine that we are designing around right now. So sound studies, visualization studies, any of their environmental monitoring that's available is very helpful in comparing the performance of that turbine.
And I've been involved in NEPA reviews of several other offshore wind projects that DOE was proposing to fund. We had the Fisherman's Energy project, the Virginia Offshore, Dominion, probably what you're more familiar with, and then also the Principal Power Project in Oregon. So we're learning a lot more as we mature the program. So, yeah. Okay, we had one online question, then we'll come back to the room. How's this season's lobstering been? So obviously that's not my area of expertise. Anyone like to
terrible.
So comments coming in are terrible and not making any money. Okay, the women in the black sweatshirt?
No.
Green. Oh, okay. Yes.
Okay. Jake, I just wanted to ask you, are those towers on off of Block Island, are they up on the platform? Or, I mean, I know they're fixed.
Yeah. So they, I would say go on to their website and you can actually see pictures. They have a,
jacket,
what they call a jacketed foundation that comes above the water. It's a yellow section. And then the tower turbine is assembled on top of that. They have some actually very interesting pictures of the installation.
Let's have a really related to that specific visual picture. Do you foresee any attending structures or vessels during the 5-year data collection period being in a sort of permanent or semi-permanent state next to the turbines?
The potential.
Can you repeat the question?
So the question was, during the 5-year monitoring period, is there potential for any other vessels that could be permanently monitored, moored out there or located out there? The potential is for MetOcean buoys and maybe a LIDAR buoy again, but it's going to be the buoy level activity that would be in the proximity of for collecting environmental and MetOcean. Similar to the Gomos buoy that's been out there for a while.
Just kind of add, in addition to Allison's question, why wasn't the Department of Energy involved in Block Island? Was it you know, did they, I'm not understand how many windmills were going up at the time to be involved, or you know, it just seems kind of important to be overlooked by something about, you know, like that.
The question was, why wasn't DOE involved in the Block Island wind farm? Alana, can you speak to that?
Sure, I can speak to that actually. Block Island had applied for Deepwater Wind for their Block Island project, had applied to DOE for funds under the Offshore Wind Demonstration Program in 2012. They had submitted an application to the DOE, and they actually decided to pull back their application because they were trying to get a loan guarantee through the DOE's loan programs office. And you cannot get both a federal grant and a federal loan from the same department. And so Block Island decided that they didn't want to proceed with an offshore wind demonstration project under the DOE's award. And so we weren't involved in that project for that reason alone, that they decided that they didn't want to be in our program. Further, the environmental review, those were done, because those didn't receive any DOE funds, they wouldn't have been done by a DOE NEPA team. They were done by the Department of Interior, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOEM, as well as the Army Corps.
Thank you. Does that answer?
Yeah.
This is for Jake, and it has to do with the LD 1465, which is the bill that was passed in 2009 for this test site. And in that bill, the second half of it addresses wave generating devices. I guess this is two parts. The first part is, are you working on any wave generating devices? And if it gets to the full scale testing stage, would you want to be using the test site and the cable for further kinds of tests in the future?
So as you correctly state, the LD 1465, or do you want to restate the question?
He was able to type it.
Okay. So again, the question was LD 1465, which is the governing law of the test site, also permits the testing of wave energy devices. And if I recall off the top of my head, there's up to three wave energy devices could be tested out there. University of Maine has been working with several companies that are developing wave energy devices. The Department of Energy, maybe Alana might know or comment about that one, actually was doing a wave energy competition as well, trying to validate or evaluate a variety of different wave energy devices. Several of them were tested in our facility, our wind wave tank. And so based on those activities, there are people that are interested in what is the next stage of scale demonstration that could be done. It's very conversational right now, but we have made them aware that the test site is, it's an allowable use of the test site. I have not talked to our electrical engineers about whether or not wave energy devices could feed into that cable at some point in time, but because this is really too premature at that point. But you know, there is additional interest in wave energy. I don't know if Alana knows any of the background of that program.
As far as going from the wave energy prize competition, which you just talked about, Jake, to the next scale, as far as I know from the department's perspective, what we're funding is an open wave energy test site on the West Coast. I am unaware of any other conversations about utilizing the main test site. So Jake, you would be the one you know more there than I do. But at least from the department's funding perspective, we are looking to test wave energy devices to scale on the West Coast.
Where the wave, the regular wave environment is more conducive to wave energy.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Could the wave energy devices be tested at the same time that the two are in operation?
So your type, do you want me to repeat that? Or you got it? So the question was, could wave energy devices be tested at the same time that the two proposed turbines are in operation? You're talking about at the Monhegan test site?
Yes.
Several things to take into consideration, which is what is the type of wave device and how big is it and what is its anchoring requirements? And then two, can you locate them in the proximity where you would have, where the predominant wave field is coming that wouldn't be shadowed by existing structures? So part of that is understanding, which we have all the data on the wind wave out there anyways, is to say, you know, if the predominant wave direction is not, you know, on the outside moving towards Monhegan and these are located on the outside, there's a lot to do with wave mechanics on how things are reflected and refracted around devices and stuff. So they're depending on the size of the device and what the footprint is, it's really a question of those types of interactions. And then the final piece is if it's actually generating electricity, how would you transport that electricity to a load, and does any of the electrical infrastructure that would already be out there for the floating platforms allow you to use some sort of connection to that or having to do something separate? And that's like as far as I can go.
That answer?
Well,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, another question.
Just to clarify, this test site is forever, as I understand. And that after a potential 20 years of the two turbines and whatever else is there, if the turbines will come down, the base is cleaned off or something. Anything else can go up there. I mean, there could be a new variety of turbine that is tested.
My humble interpretation of the way the statute is written is that there's no end of the site. There is a requirement if it's not being used to restore or remove everything. So there's decommissioning requirements for projects. But, you know, and I could be corrected by someone who knows state laws better than I do, but the interpretation is a living lab to be able to use going forward within the contents of what's permitted.
Right.
In the,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Number of years.
Yep.
Yep.
So it's not just a 20-year.
There's no site. Bob, did you have anything to add to that? I don't know if you could follow the.
Yeah, Bob would be better to answer. I should have let him.
I was like, hold on,
so
we have Bob.
He's muted, but he's
now. Oh, okay, we're unmuting you, Bob. Do you have any thoughts?
Is there a question?
Let me reread the question for you. The question was, just to clarify, this test site is forever, as I understand it, and that after a potential 20 years of two turbines and whatever else, the two turbines would come down, the bases would be cleaned off or whatever, and a new structure could go out there.
It's pretty accurate, I think.
Yeah,
it's pretty good. Voice to text.
So it kind of goes.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I think technically the law, it doesn't have an end date for the test sites, but it does talk about the testing devices have, you know, a permit period that then can be renewed. I don't think there's a limit on how many renewals there might be, but it does state that, you know, the renewals have to be for a reason, basically for the university would have to demonstrate that they need more time to test whatever it is they're testing. So it's not just granted automatically. It's a review process. After, let's say, this test with the university, after they're done and it's decommissioned and it's taken down, I suppose at some later date there could be a proposal to put something else there. But there is no end date on these test sites.
Thank you. Other thoughts, questions? Yes.
I just have one. It seems like there's a lot of roadblocks you could derail this project, all those alphabets. If this project should not get the DOE grant or whatever, I just wanted to be clear on UMaine's end, they would still be doing R&D and they would still be pursuing a full demonstration project at some point. Like the project, all the R&D isn't just going to go away.
So,
I want you to just read and shake and talk to that.
Yeah, so did you capture all that online?
So the question in summary, and Travis, please step in if you don't feel it's accurate, was that the project should not get the DOE grant. On UMaine's end, UMaine would still be doing R&D and still be pursuing a full demonstration project at some point, as all the R&D work wouldn't just go away. And then Travis pointed to Jake to maybe respond to the question. Is that accurate?
Okay. So I think that's a good question.
Hey, Jake, have you
come up? Yeah. So I think that's a good question, and it's an important thing to take into consideration. So the R&D activity that we have been involved in is really around the technology itself, and it is a critical path, and that's why I think Alana did a good job explaining why Department of Energy is looking at funding these kinds of projects to validate technology to try to harness this energy. So that doesn't mean that if, for whatever reason, if this project doesn't go forward in Monhegan, we will still pursue commercial scale demonstration is the only way to validate technology for a larger scale operation, because you're validating that the power output's going to be there, you're validating life of the structure, you're validating the impact to the environment, things like that. So full-scale demonstration is a must before we get there. So we definitely will be pursuing ways to demonstrate it at full scale, for sure, without a doubt.
The question about what other ways are out, funding sources are out there besides DOE or other ways.
Yeah, that's hard to say right now, because we've been so focused on this project, and we know everything that DOE is trying to do, and it's been a combination. It's really a three-legged stool with the state test site, and then all that activity, power purchase agreement, DOE grant, and commercial partners who have expertise to build these kind of projects, four-legged stool, I guess, right? So, and actually we're right in the middle of it all, right? So, the question is if for whatever reason the DOE grant falls through, there's a $40 million hole to fill to do something else, right? And so economics is who else would come in and fund $40 million? Maybe our good friends at the Gates Foundation or, something like that. But, so.
Or maybe Amira or DCNS or Chimbro that have billions and billions of dollars in assets, double digit banks, they turn over hundreds of millions of dollars in profits every year. They could $40 million to drop in the bucket to the size of these companies that are proposing this project. So,
I would feel very fortunate if they wrote us a check like that.
Yeah, I'm sure you would. Or if the federal government did.
Yes.
How many years of this project would it take before MAB went ahead with the larger offshore wind turbines that they plan?
Let me repeat that. Even though you're typing it in, there are some people participating just by phone, so. The next question was, how many years of this project would it take before MAB went ahead with the larger offshore wind turbine that they plan?
I'm sorry, it's trying to.
Yeah.
can repeat it. How many years of this project would it take before MAP went ahead with the larger offshore wind turbines that they have?
That's hard to predict at this point because in order to get to a bigger scale project, the technology has to be validated enough so that banks will finance bigger scale project, right? So that might be 2 to 3 years, it might be 5 to 6 years, depending on what the performance is and what predictions that can be used towards full scale. So hey, if everything went swimmingly, you know, maybe it's 3 years worth of data that show that, you know, it's a reliable technology that produces at the output that you're looking for and all that. The other part of that is in order to do a commercial scale farm, you also have to go through all the siting and locating and things like that. So there's a period of time that says proof of concept, and then there's a period of time of confidence in the concept, now looking at the steps you would go through to build a commercial farm. So in some cases, right now, and I'm going to let Alana jump in if she wants, but BOEM, Bureau of Offshore Energy Management, has already identified, permitted, or selected and auctioned off lease blocks for offshore wind in Massachusetts and New Jersey, and I think Deepwater has some spots off of Rhode Island, right? So they are in that process of validating sites. They would be looking at what kind of technology to put in there, what kind of size of projects in Massachusetts and New Hampshire or whatever. So those folks are locating sites, and their first wave of sites are near shore in shallow water where they would likely do fixed bottom technology. So that sort of starts a process of the site selection, which could then help inform commercial farms that could use floating technology that are next gen type things. So that's a long answer to say, I don't know how many years, but it's not next year. And it's probably close, it's gonna be on the outside of 5 or 6 years anyways, after you start.
That would be, I was most interested in the engineering analysis.
Yeah. Yeah,
sounds like three to six years.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's the technology, you know, making sure the output.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yes, send it back. Another one for Jake. Okay. And then I understand that the rest of the period up to the 20-year time is necessary to actually cover the cost. I'll probably pay back the investors.
Let me repeat your. Oh, sorry. Finish your thought.
No, that's okay.
No, I think so. The rest of the 20 years cover the cost. I think just cover the cost is really the key point, right? So, in order to build it, you need a certain amount of money to build it. So you're going to borrow some money. You're going to have equity investors. You know, you've got a grant, right? That's being amortized over a 20-year life, and that's the life of the turbine, that's the life of the cable, so that's financing 101. It's going to be amortized over that life. So you generate enough power every year, sell that power, and that helps pay off your expenses, the debt, and all that. Yeah. The investors would like to get paid back, yes.
Yeah.
not sure that that's going to happen, but yeah.
One more question about that. If this was to go through, have your 20 years here, but at a certain time, an offshore permits were in place. There was a farm out in deep water. Where is the university's relationship with that? I mean, isn't that something that you sell then to a group of investors, your design?
Yeah. So you got the question okay? You want me to repeat it?
We should always repeat.
Okay. Yeah. So the question is, I'm going to paraphrase it, so get me if I'm wrong, is the university has involved in the design. The design is proof of concept. If that design is used by a commercial farm, what's the relationship with that technology? Okay. So standard model is that we have patents on this.
the patents are owned by the university, and if we are able to, if the technology is utilized, then you do what's called licensing, which gives a right to use that technology under your patents during the life of the patents, and you would collect a royalty that would come back to the university and be invested into the R&D efforts and things like that. So.
I had a question about the NEPA process. So do you have an idea approximately when the draft EA will be available?
So the question is if I have an idea when the draft EA will be available for public comments. I don't. If these things can take anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, and we're at the very beginning stage of the process. And so you can imagine, we've talked about there's still some baseline studies that need to be done, and then DOE needs to vet all the data that's out there. So my guess in a perfect world would be anywhere from 12 months on. Would be a rough guess. I hate to give nut guesses because there's so many things. What typically takes more time in the NEPA process, and we use NEPA as kind of an umbrella for doing all our coordination and consultation. So you saw the slide that was up there with the alphabet soup, and all of that's going on in coordination under the endangered consultation under the Endangered Species Act, National Historic Preservation Act, all those other environmental statutes that we have to comply with. That's usually a very time-consuming process. And I don't have a lot of control over that process. You're working with other agencies that may be understaffed, have a staff of projects on their desk. So there's just, that's why I can't give you a hard and fast number.
Sure.
And I can't really go out with a draft EA until I've completed those processes, because you need that information so that you understand what the impact is.
So follow up to that is, so how is it written, like, as a layperson, am I going to understand? Is it written for a layperson to understand?
Yes, that is our goal, is to write it without using a lot of technical jargon, NEPA language, as much as we can minimize. And so we do our best to try to use what we call plain language. And it is hard. We're talking about some very complicated technical projects here. So, you know, especially in the project description, things like that, if you see things already that you don't understand, that would be a great thing to provide. Hey, this is too much jargon. Make this plain English. We can't understand what you're saying here.
Cool. And one more to that.
Yes.
Well, it's kind of towards Jake, is that, so if it takes them a year, what are you guys doing in that time? I mean, are you just going ahead and doing what you're doing, and how does that affect your schedule, I guess, is my question.
Things are going on, and you can talk to some of the things you know that you'll be doing, but things are
right,
kind of
so
progressing with all of this.
The big thing is, well, I'd say schedule-wise, most importantly, is that we have the evaluation of our baseline studies, and we get the input of additional studies that are needed so we can get those studies done so that we can get to the draft EA. So that's a lot of what's gonna happen, hopefully, you know, pending the outcome of all of this, is the ability to do cable surveys and sound and visual and the whole, we saw the whole list. Those that we've already done, get some validation of those that have been done, count, and then what else has to be done, and then we have to do those. Same time, the parallel to that is all of the on the main building and construction side is going from the engineering space that we are now and reducing that to what they call issue for construction drawings, like you're going to build a house or anything else, and going out to bidders and getting contracts and subcontracts, because all of that flows up into your financing. So you need all your permits in hand. You need all your subcontractors identified, firm fixed quotes, bids, stuff like that. All your suppliers, O&M contractors, all that stuff has to be packaged to get to your final place, which hopefully Alana says budget period 3.
So there's a lot to be done.
There's like a new administration. Is that
Let me repeat this question and we'll go online and then over here. The question was, what about the new administration and does that have impacts? And at this point, we don't have any information. And Alana, maybe you can speak to that being in Washington, D.C., our Washington, D.C. office.
I can speak to it. New administration, we do not have a confirmed secretary at this point. It is my understanding. The latest news is that Governor Perry will have his Senate, will be up for Senate vote at some point this week. Once the new administration team is fully in place, then we can, then they will be directing us, to put together a budget that will be part of the president's budget request. However, I will say that while there might be some changes in future direction, all of the funding for the demonstration projects, the two that we have going right now, has already been appropriated by Congress. Congressionally directed funds over the last 4 years have specifically gone to the demonstration project. So we have the funds that are available to support both the University of Maine and LEADCO projects in budget periods 3 through 5. So that is $80 million split among the two of them. So $40 million for each team. We have waiting ready whenever the teams reach, you know, pass their budget period to milestone. So that's short answer is, the new administration may impact future direction, but the money for the demonstration projects is already there, appropriated, and waiting for the teams to meet their criteria.
We had an online question. Patents are only good for 20 years. Is there any danger that by the time you have a viable product, that your patents will be expired and you lose the economic advantage of your intellectual property?
Yes.
Jake's response is yes.
That law.
Okay. All right.
So I had a question about the, oh, sorry. So you're going to monitor the project for the first time. And are you going to share, or will you share that monitor?
It's a question for you. The question was about the first, or DOE is monitoring the first 5 years of performance. Will that information gathered be shared with the community and the public at large?
So some of the data, like the meteorological data and site specific characteristic data, that will be available to the public immediately. There are certain things that may be held from the public for 5 years. They'll have a data hold. We have three different, basically, intellectual property provisions for the types of data that come out of these awards. Either free and open to the public. There's a category of data that have a 5-year holding period. And then there are those that are commercially sensitive. So we would have to look. I'm sorry, I can't give you a very specific answer right now. We'd have to look into the intellectual property clauses of the award to determine what exactly will be made public immediately. But the performance data, the amount of power that is being output, that is something that will be made public either immediately or within 5 years. So that data will go out. I can't tell you with certainty if it will be immediately or if it will be in that 5-year holding period.
One more, just a follow-up to that is that, so in that 5-year period, are there opportunities for public input and comment throughout that period as well?
So the question was, during that 5-year period, is there opportunity for public input or comment? Are you talking about how that on the data collection, just to clarify? Or?
And or if we have, we're having concerns and we want to, is there going to be an open communication or an availability to communicate to the DOE?
With the DOE?
Yeah.
So yeah, would there be an opportunity to communicate during that time period with the DOE? Issues or concerns?
I think that open communication with DOE during that period of time is warranted. As a program manager, I hadn't thought about the proper mechanism to putting communication lines in place, but I don't see why that can't be something that we do. And I would really recommend that comment be included in the you put that into the public comments, so that it's something that it may not be something that the NEPA team directly would address, but it's definitely something that we at headquarters can think about how best to put something in place so that there can be open lines of communication throughout the 5 years of data collection.
Thanks, Alana. Yes, please include that in the written comments. Thank you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was wondering if you could just briefly go through how you review public comment.
So the question is, briefly, how NEPA reviews the public comment and what the process is. So once we complete the comment gathering period, which ends on March 22nd, then we go back and review all the comments that are submitted. We that actually goes into the EA. And so there will be a response. We do what's called a comment response matrix. So the comment, if it's like a question about noise impacts, we'll have a matrix that says this is addressed in EA Chapter 3, Section blah, blah, blah. So you will be able to go to the document when it's drafted and see how your comment was responded to. Prior to that, I'm planning on posting the comment and responses as we're drafting the EA. So you can see it. I don't have to wait months and months to see how your comment's being impacted. So that's what the overall process looks like.
So it's you reading them?
Yes.
Or? Thank you.
I will read each one. It is fun and interesting and all of those things. And when you get into this field, this is one of the few federal statutes that allows for public involvement into what a federal agency is doing. So that's why a lot of people get involved in this field. So we take it serious and we really encourage. This is where we want to hear. We want you to understand the process. People get frustrated because they don't fully understand it. And this is your time to really have your voice be heard. And so you may not always like how we address your comments. There are constraints in the NEPA process, but this is your voice. Don't hold back because of past frustrations or concerns that we're just, you know, toss it aside. We take this serious, and this is why we're here. We want to hear from you up front, so that we can make sure that you do have the information you need and that we do a thorough EA. Thank you. Thank
you. Take
yes,
that.
Yeah. Do I what?
Take that.
Just credit card. Very right, Tom. No.
How is the public noticed about the comment period for the Army Corps of Engineers?
Okay, this is a question for you, Jay. I think I know the answer, but it's your area. The question is, how is the public notified about the Army Corps of Engineers public notification process? Is that correct?
Well, the application, when it comes in, requires a listing of, typically it requires a listing of abutters in this case, and normally we're looking at folks that are within 1,000 feet of a given project. In this case, we're going to exceed that, but we'll have to figure out exactly who will be on a quote unquote list in the application. But above and beyond whoever's listed as an abutter or a riparian property owner or what have you, We do notify a whole host of news agencies, newspapers. We notify the local post office for posting in the lobby or what have you. We notify the town, you know, whether it's selectmen or planning board or town manager or whatever they may have. And then a small island community like that, I have no doubt that word will get around. The challenge, I think, the bigger challenge will be, how do we notify, or who do we notify on the mainland side? But the interest, obviously, is to reach out as broadly as we can to whoever may be affected. We have a whole host of entities that are on our standard mailing list for Maine. We have standard mailing lists for each of the states. But at this early stage, my advice would be, if you wish to be on a list for future notifications by the Corps, and you believe there's some risk that you might miss out in some way, just send me an email. Lori has my contact information that she can share there. I didn't provide a slide, but she has all the information. And if she doesn't, then can get it to you. And just send me a quick email, send me a letter, drop me a phone call, and I have a file already started on this project, have had one for quite a while. And so I will include your information such that when we develop the mailing list for our process, I will include you on that list.
I would be happy to provide a link to Jay's email on the DOE webpage, if you guys would like me to do that.
That would be great.
Okay, I'll do that. Okay. It probably will be early next week. I'll get that up on the webpage. And along with that, like I had mentioned, these posters that we have here in the room that we've used at our public meetings are available for your download. And we'll get this presentation from tonight on that webpage. Okay, we're lots of yawns, tired faces. So one last opportunity? Looking online.
Do we get helicopter eyes if the Army Corps brings one of those big choppers up?
I get to go first.
Definitely.
So Phil, if you want to stick around in the room for a little longer to ask any more questions, we'll facilitate that. I know we're all getting tired, but we'll let our online folks go to bed for the night, and thanks for your participation, and really DOE wants to hear from you. I can't emphasize that enough. Please provide comments. This is one of two opportunities for you to really get your comments out there.
Just one more piece. So just so folks know and the folks online know, we did record the session. However, because of the difficulty we had with the internet connection, the initial maybe 5 minutes will not be present on the recording. However, the entire Q&A section has been recorded successfully, and so that will be available through Lori's portal. So just so folks know, have that expectation. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Everyone help. Grab a chair.